from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the GoodAtheist.net podcast. My name is Jacob Fortan.
And I am Ryan Harkness.
Ryan Harkness. Today on the bonus show, we're going to be talking about the one thing that I guess no one can stop talking about, and that is the Pope. Yes, we're going to talk about this scandal more because it's just dominating the headlines and just the imagination of people.
Well, how often does a Pope really get caught with,
with this kind of steamy controversy?
And it's so annoying because, you know, over the past, how long have we been hearing that term smoking gun thrown around for all sorts of political things? Then finally, someone gets caught. There's a smoking gun in a case I actually care about where the Pope is being caught shifting around one of these molester fuckface rapist priests, and no one's using the term smoking gun. I'm like, it's a smoking gun! We tied it. It's tied. It is there. Fucking okay. Matlock figured it out. The Pope is guilty.
The other thing we're going to be talking about is coping with death. Not you having to cope with it, but you coping with the death of a loved one. I received a letter from one of the fans who mentioned that one of her family members had died. And in the letter, she asked me sort of like, well, do you have any, you know, what would you suggest is a way to help somebody cope that doesn't believe in God? Mm. Which I thought was kind of like an interesting question because, you know, we dealt a couple of weeks back. We had a death show. And I swear to you, the death show has been one of the more popular shows and generated so many comments, so many emails from people that wanted to share their thoughts on it, that I realized that when you don't have, like, say, other religions, they have an agreed-upon story, right? They're like, okay, when you die, you go to heaven.
They've got that template.
They've got the template, but everybody who's an atheist, they don't have no stinking template, so everybody thinks about it in their own kind of weird way. And I think that's the kind of coolest thing about it, that people share their insights about what it really does mean to die and how to cope with that shit when you know that's going to happen.
Here's how it works for us atheists. The collar gets a little bit tighter, you get a little bit sweatier, you have to run a little bit faster from death.
What is it? I don't even understand what that means. Does that mean it's like exercise?
It's just my crazed, afraid, watch out for death atheism thing. Because I hope you have a good answer. Because I was thinking about this, and I'm like, all I have is that, you know, we're worm food. It's very unfortunate. Try not to think about it too much, because it'll fuck you up if you really get obsessed about it.
Well, I had some thoughts about it in terms of why I think that we are kind of conditioned to have to, or how we've dealt with death in the past, you know, because the funny thing about it, you can think that a person is religious because they fear death and therefore believe in God, and believe in the afterlife. But I've always found that it's not so much a person's own personal fear of death that makes them want to think of, or want to believe that heaven is true, but really the death of other people, which is kind of this. We are as such an empathetic and caring ape. Mm-hmm. We find ourselves in positions where we start caring for people like a lot, and then these people fucking die on us. They selfishly stop existing. And
or that truck selfishly runs them down,
or the boulder selfishly crushes them, or the tar pit.
The tiger selfishly eats them.
Yeah, or the tar pit selfishly engulfs them. All kinds of horrible ways that us monkeys die. Mm. But anyways, one of the things that I realized is you continue to have a relationship with the person that is deceased in a couple of ways. The first and most obvious way is the disposal of the body. Mm-hmm. So the person is dead, but now you've got to get rid of their fucking corpse. Mm-hmm. That's the first and most, probably the biggest problem with this whole death thing. You have to deal with the carcass of the now deceased. Mm-hmm. And this thing is a bother. Let me tell you. What do you do with it? All right? So you're just a regular ape like any other ape. One of your ape friends dies. What the fuck do you do? You got to get rid of it, right?
Yeah, it goes to the morgue, and then you got to make
No, I'm asking you to put yourself in the position of a primitive group that does not even have an understanding of death, and all of a sudden somebody dies, you don't know what to do. They're a corpse now. You're like, what the fuck is going on?
Let me tell you what. Back then, I feel like it's probably about as hard as dealing with an old mattress. You just fucking take it somewhere away from you and leave it there.
Well, here's if you look at our backyard. There's a big gigantic mattress. Weren't we supposed to put that out last night so that it could have gotten picked up?
Yeah? This morning.
Did we do that?
No.
How long has that mattress been out there?
7 months.
All right. So it would seem to me that if we did deal with it like a mattress, it would be bad news. We would have a dead relative in the backyard for 7 months, not wanting to touch it or deal with it.
Yes.
So I'm just, okay. So my point is the first thing that you have to do when a person dies is you have to deal with the fact that there is some kind of leftover, okay, of this person, which is going to be the first way that you are still maintaining a kind of relationship with them. The other way that you're going to have a relationship with them is that there are probably going to be certain things, transactions that are going to need to happen. If it's a relative, there's an inheritance of either money or property or all this other kind of stuff. And we as a species, as a very superstitious species, we often put personality on objects that belong to people. So if I give you a scarf, and I just say this is a new scarf, or I give you a scarf and I said that belonged to someone who recently died, you would have a reaction to the second scarf more than you would have to the first, because you make some associations about that. The death seems to carry over as some weird, creepy vibe regarding the person's things.
But yeah, I will agree that it definitely makes it creepier, but I just want to put it out there that I won't wear someone else's hat unless it's like a hot chick's hat. I'll wear a hot chick's hat at a party, but other than that, I don't want to wear a man's hat, especially not a dead man's hat. That's creepy.
Okay,
I will admit
whatever,
to the extra creepy factor. I'm just putting it out there that other people's clothing in general is creepy.
All right, fine.
I know
you
don't.
My point is, I don't generally care as much now. My point.
You've worn a dead man's jacket for several months.
Many, many months. An entire winter. Yeah. He had recently passed, too. I mean, I needed a jacket. I was poor. It wasn't even that warm, but, you know, it did the job. It did the job it needed to do. What I'm trying to say here is that the reason that it's so difficult is just because you have to deal with it when the people are still dead. So if you have a relationship with a person, even if they're deceased, it's going to be natural for you to assume that maybe some essence of them must still be present in order for you to be able to have such a relationship. That you could feel like the presence in the person when you were wearing his hat or his scarf, which is why maybe it feels so creepy. That you feel as though there is, you know, like when you walk into a room and you feel like you're being watched, okay? It's a really primitive instinct, and it's usually not very logical at all. But I think that that's kind of one of the instincts that we have regarding people that, you know, have recently passed away. And I think that would make us susceptible to the idea that maybe they do indeed exist in some form even after they die.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you already have to interact with them. Of course you're going to give them a form. It's necessary. How else are you supposed to deal with all of this history that you've had with them? How much, you know, things that they've owned that you either now have to deal with and sell off or even continue to own yourself? Because you have to imagine back in the day, you know, a person died and you inherited that shit. You're going to keep it, all right? You're not going to throw it away, all right? You already don't have a lot of wealth, and now you're going to just sort of take everything that was theirs. That's going to make it really, really personal.
I don't know. The way I kind of look at it is that quote that you kept on pulling up kind of goes with what I was always feeling, was that death is probably going to be, you know, post-life is going to be pretty similar to pre-life, and that was okay. So we don't have to worry about that. And it's actually quite nice to know that no one's going to be burning in hell. I would rather everybody go nowhere than some people go to hell. Past that point, anybody that gets to live a full life, they got a good kick at the can. That's awesome. I totally agree with anybody that wants to fall down on their knees, wail, and pull out their hair at anybody who is taken early. That fucking sucks, because they didn't get their full turn.
Yeah, they didn't get their chance.
I mean, we recognize as atheists how valuable existence is. We understand the statistical anomaly of us,
our existence?
Of our existence, of all of the weird, you know, that egg, that sperm, just the fact that we're here at all. and that we're born into this awesome society with all of this technology and coolness, and we get to download shit off the internet and
listen to it and watch it. Just try not to think about what the odds of you not being around here and a different person being born is. Just, you don't even want to know.
Oh, so you just got to seize on the idea that it's precious, and it definitely sucks when people die, but death isn't such a bad thing. So
maybe that's what you can tell people that are atheists that have, you know, lost someone. Death is not such a bad thing. It's not a bad state, so you don't need to worry about that, first of all. It's not a bad state. It's not a good state. It's just no state at all. There is no state.
I can definitely understand why people would choose existence over non-existence.
Well, dig this. This morning, I get a ring-a-ding-ding at the door, and lo and behold, it's some Jehovah's Witnesses.
Came back. They were the ones I told to come back and talk to you.
Yeah, so if you're a fan of the show, you might have recalled a couple of weeks ago, Ryan mentioned that they had showed up, but I think I was gone in Calgary at the time.
Yep.
And you had asked them to come back. So come back they did. And I was like, I invited them in and decided to talk to them. I think we probably talked for about half an hour. I wanted to know what their pitch was going to be. Mm-hmm. This is what I always love about religious people. What's their first pitch? You know, when they walk in, how do they try to introduce you to their really just flawed logic? It may seem to be pretty solid to them, but I mean, trust me, it's highly flawed.
Well, the chick sounded, because it was what, like a 40-ish year old woman and an 80-ish year old woman?
Woman probably was in her 60s.
See, it's unfortunate. The first time they came, it was like a 40-ish year old woman and like her hot Polish 20-year-old daughter. So
I hope the whole troop comes next time, because I think that Polish woman wants to come back with her husband, who is probably much more theologically well-armed.
Mm-hmm.
So she was probably like, he's a tough nut to crack. Maybe I can bring my husband. I'm like, bring it on. Bring it on.
Yeah, so what was the first argument that they had? When they came in, you said, okay, lay it on me. Where did they try and, you know, stick in their pry bar and start pulling?
Well, one of the major ones that they were just trying to talk about, and this was their pitch literally to me. They were saying, well, wouldn't it be a lot of comfort knowing that your family or your loved ones are waiting for you in heaven?
That was the first one they went to. Well, how about that? How about that?
So you can see that is often a really popular sales pitch. I've heard it multiple times. I remember my dad's one of my dad's ex-girlfriends. She lost her husband, and she was kind of like part of this weirdo quasi cult that they had managed to kind of drag her in at the death of her husband, because she was, you know, like, they offered the same pitch. Wouldn't it be great knowing that you're going to be with this person
again?
Which I think you can imagine how healthy that is in any relationship, where the girl that you're dating is hoping to see that guy again in heaven. You're just like, where does that leave me exactly?
Oh, you're so young and naive, Jake. By the time you're like 50, you give up on the hope that you're the best person your mate has ever met.
No, no, no. I don't think
that you're the one that's going to get matched
not,
up in heaven
that
with not, that other
that
person.
That is not it, fool. But I mean, evidently, any man's going to be jealous of guys that happened that were in the past, and it's difficult when all of a sudden, you know, like a person begins to like the beautification of them, as in sort of like the saintliness of the raises their saintliness, like, oh, he never did anything wrong, or he was the perfect husband, that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden you are compared to that person. You see, this is what this kind of behavior causes.
Mm-hmm.
It just creates an imaginary boyfriend that you, or husband that you can't compete against.
Mm-hmm.
Who's waiting for her in heaven, okay?
I always thought that was kind of what Jesus was like this imaginary boyfriend that you can't beat.
Don't you think that there's probably quite a few nuns that definitely feel that way? They're like, no man is good enough for me. I'm going to go with the world's most perfect boyfriend, Jesus.
There must be some. You got to figure that people must masturbate to Jesus. It must happen.
I wonder how they feel about that one.
I don't know. This must be weird.
That's a quandary. Anyways, so yeah, that was one of their angles. I'm not going to say it's the only one that they tried, because trust me, by the time I was done talking to them, they were most distressed. And yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think the argument that I provided to them that they really could not argue against, the one that they had the most trouble with, was one of the simplest ones that I proposed. because at one point they were saying, well, the Bible read correctly, you know, interpreted correctly. And I came back with them with a really salient point of saying, well, here's the thing. In Christianity alone, there are roughly over 30,000 different sects that interpret the Bible differently, let alone probably individuals' interpretations that may even differ on a one-to-one basis. Mm. And I'm like, if one book can be interpreted in that in so many ways, then there is absolutely and utterly no truth to the statement that it needs to be interpreted correctly. It would seem impossible to do so. And if it's impossible to interpret correctly, then it must be interpreted literally. And if you were to interpret it literally, you would go to jail for everything that this book tells you to do. Mm. So they had a bit of trouble with that one.
Yeah, I definitely like. I liked how you brought your pet story up. The guy who didn't come in his brother's.
Oh yes,
wife.
The story of Onan.
Onan, yes.
I was bringing that up as saying, well, you know, if you're trying to extrapolate a moral tale out of that, and you're saying, okay, so God tells Onan, fuck your widow, your brother's widow, and make children. So Onan has sex with her, but pulls out, and boom, God kills him. And God, I think, kills very few people in the Bible directly. The only ones that I know of are Aaron's two sons, who burnt incense improperly and were obliterated by God in Leviticus. Which Aaron is told, by the way, that he's not allowed to cry or show emotion.
They got some on the rug. It's a big no-no.
It just burned funny. The incense burned funny is what it basically says. Hmm. So God kills them both. But anyways, there are very few people that God actually sets out to kill himself. Onan is one of them. Now, I said you can interpret that a number of ways. One way that you can interpret that, which is what the Catholic Church has decided to interpret as, is that you cannot, like the commandment, be fruitful and multiply, is what he violated. Therefore, condoms are bad because they prevent you from being fruitful and multiplying. Mm-hmm. Although another person could simply interpret that as saying, well, he broke God's commandment, and that's why he was killed.
Well, what I liked is that was what that old lady had picked up. When you told that story, her immediate reaction to that story was that he disobeyed God. And she didn't seem to read anything too far past that. But I just thought it was a good way to show that, hey, everybody interprets it differently. And it can be very dangerous when you don't interpret it right.
Or there is no right
right. Yeah.
There's no right when it comes to interpretation. That's inherently the problem. If you can't tell what's right, then none of it is. Hmm. And it's useless. It's absolutely useless. So a person could say, like, this is our moral guide. And I'm like, it's not a good moral guide because it merits interpretation. And interpretation immediately tells you that it is not some moral absolute, but rather just some weird moral interpretation of whoever decided arbitrarily that this one particular story should mean this or that. I mean, it's absolute rubbish. But anyways, that long story short, they're probably going to be back, so I'm probably gonna have more stories for you guys. Maybe I should record the next conversation, because it is, I don't think they'd agree to it, but I was actually even thinking of going to one of the, they have this celebration thing or whatever as to why Jesus had to die, and I'm almost curious enough to just go to see what their rationale for Jesus having to die is. Because I always found that sanguine tale to be bloodthirsty at the very least. At the very least. I'm like, seriously? This guy had to be tortured to death for the good of us? I'm like, I don't really see how that actually
makes any sense.
Not only does it not make sense, but what a morally reprehensible act needed to somehow justify acts of goodness. I'm like, that doesn't make any sense to me. It's absolutely and utterly disgraceful and despicable that a God would even require such a thing, would require a sacrifice of his own son / himself to appease a decision that he had made before.
Well, you know, all these people, that argument a lot of people say of how can God do this? It's so evil and bloodthirsty and how can God allow these things to happen? Back when the Bible was written, the world was an even harder place.
Oh, yeah, it was pretty hard.
So, of course, they're going to square it up and they're going to say, hey, is God going to require horrible things to happen in order for change? It's like, he requires horrible things to happen all the time. It's part of some fucked up plan. We don't understand it.
But God is harsh.
Yep. God is not a friendly man.
No. God is tsunami killing 200,000 people in one shot harsh. you know, according to these people. Mm-hmm. So it's
tectonic plate harsh.
Tectonic plate harsh.
Yeah. Them tectonic plates are a bitch.
Speaking of harshness, let's move on. I think we've dealt with this situation enough. Let's just talk about. I want to talk about Sinead O'Connor for 5 seconds. You remember back in the 90s, she's on Saturday Night Live. She sings a tribute song of Bob Dylan's War, but replaces racism with child abuse, and then rips up a poster of Pope John Paul II saying, "Fight the real enemy." And everybody on the set, silent, like you would not believe. Not one word. Everyone was like, holy moly. To this day, NBC will not replay that scene. They won't even allow that scene to be seen. So it's still that controversial to this day. And you think to yourself, man, if Sinead O'Connor did that today with the picture of Pope Ratzinger, would there be as much controversy as there was back then? Are we in a different place now in terms of how the general public feels about the authority of the church? About the need for, you know, sort of like this weird reverence that doesn't allow people to question their actions?
I don't know. We're in a weird place because it seems very obvious to me that everybody cares in a general sort of way. This story is getting a lot of press now, and it's not stopping. It's, you know, it's for the last week, it's been on the front page of the major website news websites every day. But on the other hand, nothing's happening. None of the people who you can take a paper trail and follow along. These are the people that covered up child rape. None of these people are being tried or going to jail or you know, having police investigations against them. That whole side of it, if it's happening, I'm not reading about it. It doesn't seem like it's moving towards that. It just seems very strange to me that it's not even really being looked at from a legal light where it's like, hey, you've got a whole bunch of people who allowed child rape to happen. We recognize the fact that it's obviously a widespread situation, but nobody is getting off their ass and doing anything serious about it. Well, I mean, we're all talking about it. We're all freaking out about it, but no one's doing anything.
Is the Swiss Guard supposed to arrest him in his own independent state? I mean, the Vatican is a city-state, okay? It's its own little country. So it has its own little laws. To prosecute him, you have to prosecute him as sort of like a...
No, you wouldn't. These kids were all over the world, man. And I'm not talking about go after the Pope. You know, I obviously, because of the facts that have come out, the Pope being in charge of basically everything during the time when a lot of this shit was going down, the fact that he was directly overseeing one of those German guys that got moved around.
The one that was known formally only as H, because they wouldn't release his name.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we've caught him in enough of his shit, but I'm talking about there's a number of other people who were specifically, you know, one degree removed from moving these people around and doing stuff, and still nothing is happening to these people. These people aided and abetted child rape
and
covered it up.
It's crazy, too, that when you think about, there's a statute of limitation on how long you can prosecute someone for child rape. Like, there's a statute. Mm-hmm. Which I always found to be
ridiculous.
Absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And you know, when that whole covenant of the doctrine of the faith that Ratzinger was head of, the one that was supposed to examine the cases of molestation, the one that he obviously knowingly failed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the hilarious thing about that is, you know, it was written with that statute in mind, saying, well, if we can move them around or just whisk them away until the statute is reached, then it won't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just wait for it all to blow over. This is basically their idea. And of course, to do this, they just whisk them away to other places where they will just offend again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, under the whole reason that Reverend Peter Hullerman, which was the name of the guy that you were talking about, they had started an inquiry within the church until he had personally asked
John Paul II
for to just be allowed to live with, you know, like his life and to get over it. I'm never going to do that again.
It was a long time ago. I'm fine now. Let me die as a priest.
Exactly. So,
and they said okay.
Yeah,
it's just that fucked up attitude. It's that I mean, even look at, say, outside of the religious zone. It was Roman Polanski that basically raped that kid.
That's right. Yeah.
Plied her with drugs and raped her.
She was like
her.
13 years old.
Yeah, and I was listening to a lot of NPR down in the States when that whole case was happening. And there was a lot of people like, oh, you're persecuting Polanski and leave him alone. And it was a long time ago and it doesn't matter. I'm just like, what? I don't even understand how anybody, I mean, this is child rape. It's insane that this kind of stuff that people don't seem to care all that much about it. People just don't. There's that weird double standard where it's fucking cranked to the hilt as far as how you're supposed to react. But as far as how things are actually dealt with in the real world, nothing seems to happen. I mean, remember growing up, and you know, you read a lot about this from people who go to Christian schools or Catholic schools and stuff like that. They grow up a lot around the clergy, and a lot of them would identify that priest that was the fucking molester. Father, feel me up, the guy who touches you. You know, and growing up, I don't know about you in your life, but in my life, there were some people that you'd see that you were like, those people are probably wrong, and yet nothing fucking happens to them. It just...
Well, the problem... Here was the thing. The Vatican tried to wash everything under the bridge by saying that the police had done an investigation and they didn't pursue. What they don't say is that they didn't release any information to the police. So if the police don't have anything to go on, they won't prosecute. Plus, the kids that had been molested were forced to sign something saying that they wouldn't talk about it. Wow, gee, I wonder why the police never had enough evidence to convict these guys. I think the most disgusting thing about the whole thing is that obviously the Vatican has enough information. They keep good records. They have enough information that could definitely convict all of these priests that have acted inappropriately, that have molested or worse, even sort of forcibly raped these kids. Mm. They probably know all that shit. They don't want any of their records to be open and seen by the general public, by police, by law enforcement, nobody. They just don't think it's anybody else's business. And definitely if you were to ask them what is worse, abortion or child rape, abortion will win every day of the week. And this is just how they feel. Different priorities. And they know, good God, do they know that if that shit came out, it leaked out, it would cost them every single dime that they have. Look, the Catholic Church is rich, but it ain't that rich. It can't survive hundreds and hundreds and thousands of, you know, litigation from individuals who were molested by priests. It can't handle it. Mm-hmm. It will go bankrupt. This is why we need that to happen.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because this seems like, a while ago we were talking about what we felt was the most likely way for the church to kind of go down. And because when you look at mainstream Christian organization, the Catholic Church is, as far as I'm concerned, the big one. You know, the Protestants are just fucking, are just doing themselves and just by not being anything and not standing. The Protestants are just slowly bleeding out. Catholic Church is still pretty powerful, though. Once these guys go down, and I originally was going to point it towards, you know, their hard line against gays is what's going to take them down. But I'm thinking this child rape thing is only getting worse. We're only going to be hearing more stories. It's already to the point where it's hard to keep up between, oh, these deaf kids over here who were raped.
In Wisconsin.
The ones in Wisconsin who were raped, the ones in Germany who were raped, the ones in Ireland who were raped. It's getting really hard to keep up. It's just, there was a lot of rape going on everywhere. A lot.
And the hilarious thing about this is how poorly the Vatican is really dealing with the situation.
Oh, it's hilariously epic. Bad.
I'm going to issue an apology? What is this, the 13th century when people fucking cared about that shit?
But the Pope didn't release an apology. It wasn't any kind of meaningful apology.
No, it's nothing. It's more like, sorry you suffered, rape victims.
No, yeah, nobody with a critical mind that read the Pope's apology letter was impressed at all. There was no signs that they were going to do anything about themselves, about the situation that had allowed this to happen, and about the situation that allowed it to be covered up. Because that's the creepy thing. Not just that it happened, but that it was covered up. And that when you think about the fact that...
And covered up again and again and again.
Again and again. And yeah, and you start to get the idea, well, this is just what we know about. How much is there that we don't? And there's got to be a
ton. It's like the iceberg phenomenon, right? Yeah. You see 10% of it, you don't see 90% of it.
Well, what happens next? If we uncover something else that it turns out that the Vatican knew about, if a new region finds out that a priest that got moved there was raping everybody, and more paperwork comes out and the Vatican's like, yeah, we knew about that one too. What happens then? Do we just go through this ridiculous cycle once more? Do people forget the fact that they already quote-unquote fessed up?
I don't know. I mean, it's like a person guilty of... You know what it is? It's exactly like Tiger Woods, where he's like, I confess that I cheated on my wife, and then another person comes forward, and then another person comes forward. It's like, maybe you should have done all the confessing in one shot, because when you make a confession but you don't admit to all the wrong... Then every time something new that happens, it's just reopening that wound. Mm. And as long as they can't expunge that element out of their midst, you know, information is just better at traveling. This is what the Catholic Church doesn't understand. Their whole secrecy thing that they've been really good at keeping, you can say goodbye to that now, okay? Goodbye to it. There's just too much information out there now. And it's just, you will be found out. You will be fucking found out. You can't hush the world.
Yeah, I always find it funny people who still think they live in an age where privacy and secrets are still easily kept. It's like they really aren't.
It's like if you want to keep a secret, don't tell even one person. It has to be yours. Mm-hmm. So to you secret mass murderer somewhere out there, serial killer, don't tell anybody. Shh. Don't tell anybody.
Keep it quiet.
It's going to get out if you don't. Okay, you know what? I think we should wrap up the show. That's enough Pope hate for one day. It's the third show on the Pope.
It's going to be going on for a while.
I know. It'll be going on for a while. We'll try to keep it relevant.
People, tell us whether or not you're sick of Pope hate or want more Pope hate. And we'll...
we will provide that because you are our bosses.
Yeah, we'll turn the spigot and we'll gauge it like that. If you guys want us to cover it some more, we will, because it's fucked up.
Yeah, and you know, this is the first bonus show we put back up in the content well since my time in Calgary. So you guys have been waiting for this for a little while. We'd like to just say that we're back on regular schedule for all our podcasting. So we're kind of over the travel hump. I managed to do all right, but I mean it's difficult when you travel and when you're out and about to. To catch up, but don't worry, we'll keep on churning these puppies and we'll keep on entertaining you for as long as we possibly can. Okay, with that, my name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Ryan Harkness.
Have a good Atheist Day, everybody.